From Television City, in New York, Al Goldstein presents Midnight Blue.
A big, fat, obese man like me having sex on Midnight Blue? It's disgusting.
Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone. We've been having some technical difficulties here at the recently reoccupied Gore Lieberman Studios. As promised, we are using our new mic setup.
But it may not be the permanent mic setup, though. There's been a lot of debate. There's been a lot of argument. There's been a lot of pulling out of hair, getting it to work, getting various outdated systems to work. It's been a mess, folks.
Yeah, we were 40 minutes into trying to get the new setup to work. And by the way, this is after we're going to break the fourth wall a little bit on this one. And of course, we're rolling the dice anyway that this audio survives. So this may never be this may never be heard by anybody. But Will actually came over yesterday to record, you know, triumphantly with our new mic setup. We were going to name the microphones Gore and Lieberman respectively. We had it all worked out, and then he didn't have the USB splitter to make it work. So we actually had a pretty nice little hangout. You know, we don't do that as much anymore. You know, often when we're hanging out, it's kind of monetized, it's commodified. But he came back today, you know, mic splitter in hand, and we thought, let's do it. And we do have...
Turns out we didn't even need the mic splitter. It was another problem.
Well, and then...
I just want to tell you, folks, Justin handles everything on my other podcast, so I'm learning with you.
Well, normally the engineers at the Gore Lieberman Studios, of course, would be handling all this, but, you know, there's been a walkout, and out of principle, you know, we're not going to bring in scabs because we respect workers' rights. Actually, we just have Will scabbing instead. But we were 40 minutes or so into, our frustrating trying to set the damn thing up when Will revealed to me, this was just a few moments ago, that he's using an ancient MacBook Air. It's like, why does it keep crashing? It's like, gee, I wonder, because your computer's fucking steam-powered, bro.
It's not that. How dare you air our dirty laundry on air in front of my fans? But secondly, it was clearly the splitter that was doing it. But listen, folks, I am glad that I made the trip down to the Young and Dundas Best Buy today to spend $50 on that splitter that I didn't need, because I was able to drop by one of the used bookstores.
Your Patreon money going to good use, folks.
I was able to drop by a used bookstore in the area called BMV, where I scored 5 vintage issues of Screw magazine. And I wanted to bring this up on this cool and chill Patreon episode, because we talked about Hugh Hefner last week. And I think we both agreed, not a very good man. We had some issues with him.
But then again, it's Screw magazine.
Well, Al Goldstein, a saint. Hugh Hefner projected the image of sort of the waspish, sophisticated pornographer. Al Goldstein was proudly, defiantly, slovenly, and hideous, and somebody who reveled in his own filth. And you know, he was really the people's pornographer. And I'd like to read his editorial in issue number 1091.
I've never seen one of these before. So, I mean, you collect these. What do you do?
Well, I keep them in the closet, and occasionally I look at them. I like to consider it preservation more than anything. I mean, so Screw magazine's a beautiful thing, because like this is a primary source document. This was the Consumer Reports of sex in New York City.
This is your version of like me collecting Tony Benn's diaries.
Well, you know what? Actually, because it's not like anyone really is preserving this stuff, and there are whole communities and worlds in New York that were preserved in the pages of these magazines that have been steamrolled into oblivion by Giuliani and Ed Koch and everyone who has come since. Now, this issue is January 29th, 1990, so it's quite a bit past the golden age of Screw. Back there was like a 5-year period in the 70s when Screw was kind of hip. When they had
James Baldwin writing for them. They had Norman Mailer.
Okay, I mean
Joan Didion.
Here's the thing, though. They did interview John and Yoko at their bed-in.
That's like, pretty crazy.
They interviewed Henry Miller. They interviewed Jack Nicholson when he was at the height of his stardom. Like, it was kind of because they were fighting First Amendment cases. You know, they were on the cutting edge of something or other back in the 70s. So there was this brief period when it was sort of hip. Now by 1990, I think it was basically just, you know, readership had dwindled back to just the solitary masturbators. And that's where this one comes from. But Al Goldstein in his editorials, you know, most of his battles had been won at this point. He'd had this very important lawsuit. You know, he was put on trial for like transportation of obscene materials over state lines. And in 1976, he was tried in Kansas, and the trial ended up in a hung jury because the jury could not come to a consensus that the material was erotic, because
it was too gross.
To say that it was erotic, you had to say that you were aroused by it. And the jury could not come to a consensus.
The jury in this red state was too like shy to admit it.
Yes.
So I love you say he'd won all his battles by this point. Like, just imagining, you know, he, like Alexander the Great, he's on the, you know, the banks of the Ganges weeping because there are no worlds left to conquer.
Well, at that point, I would say his editorials became very much about like just businesses in New York that he didn't like. So here's one. So the editorial is called "Screw You" by Al Goldstein. The headline is "The Shriveling of Bloomingdale's." Bloomingdale's, the bloated retailer that treated its customers like dog shit, went belly up recently, filing for bankruptcy under a criminally inept management felled by its own greed. Excuse me while I dance on its grave. Excuse me while I howl at the moon with pleasure at the deadly certitude of the Goldstein curse. Excuse me while I say, I told you so. I had battled with Bloomingdale's shameless disregard for human decency before, but the official levying of the Goldstein curse against Bloomingdale's occurred in Screw number 915, dated September 15th, 1986. At the time, the store was a booming concern, boasting a vast sales force and an international reputation. Chairman Alfred Bloomingdale once told the New York Post why he didn't buy advertising in it. Your readers are our shoplifters. And this type of high-handed arrogance was typical of Bloomies before the fall. The Goldstein curse went to work. Follow-up frothing appeared in Screw number 962, 968, and 1007. There were only additional stakes hammered into the heart of the vampire, since Bloomingdale's was a member of the Walking Undead as soon as the famous Goldstein curse was first leveled against it. A few short years later, Bloomingdale's fabled empire is in ruins. It is a massive, rotting pustule on Robert Campeau's pig-like face, ready to burst all over the bankruptcy courts. It's as simple as night and day. In this corner, the Goldstein curse. In the other corner, any enemy you choose to name. The bolt of doom strikes swift and steady. The Goldstein curse is unvanquished. And then beneath it is a collage of past editorials in the editorial section of Goldstein cursing Bloomingdale's and cheering its demise.
You know what this is like? It makes me think of like if Donald Trump was like, I don't know, 25% more eloquent. You know, like if Donald Trump could write a sentence, then, you know, it would be like this, because he seems like the kind of person, you know, Donald Trump just, you know, seems guided by these like stupid beefs he has. You know, it's more with like New York media, but like by extension, it's just like these really petty feuds he has with like various New York institutions. Like you can imagine Donald Trump going on like a tirade against Bloomingdale's and talking about how it's no longer what it once was.
I mean,
like,
he's done it to what was that department store that like people like Chelsea Handler were taking pictures of themselves, like holding stuff they'd bought from it early in the Trump presidency. Oh God, I can't. Anyway, it doesn't even fucking matter.
That's what it reminds me of.
Things like that, because he has done that. Uh-huh. Yeah,
like I guess just that's the provincialism of you know New York culture, just in the sense that, you know, when you're so big and you're so influential, like, you know, a place like New York can be sort of a universe unto itself, and so. You know, if you're a guy like Al Goldstein or Donald Trump, zillionaire real estate baron, former president of the United States, also, I should say, you know, you can spend your time getting mad about like Anna Wintour's parties or how, you know, standards are falling at Bloomingdale's. I fucking love it.
Yeah, I remember an early issue of Screw Magazine, also in the Will Sloan collection. He used to have a column called The Shit List, where he would curse out various things that had gotten his ire. And I think in one of them, this is from like the early 70s, he was cursing putting Woody Allen on his shit list, who at the time was very much like a New York institution, for the crime of saying he would do an interview in Screw and then not doing an interview in Screw and then like ignoring the phone calls after that, which is a very Trumpian thing to do. It's like there's no like broader politics to the assault. It's just you've disrespected me because you didn't want to be in my porno rag.
This is only tangentially related, but I was thinking about this week, one of my favorite, I guess we could say reverse engineered sort of Trump Twitter offensives, which was that time where Bret Stephens, I guess, was name searching himself. So, you know, Bret Stephens, the insufferable, pompous right-wing columnist that they have in the New York Times op-ed section for balance or whatever. Bret Stephens was name searching and he found some, like, I don't know, some like junior academic somewhere who like called him a bug or an insect or something like that. Tweet had like two interactions or whatever. So then Bret Stephens like wrote, if I'm remembering the sequence of events correctly, Bret Stephens wrote a New York Times column about how, you know, that he'd been called a bug or something like that.
And now we need stronger controls on the internet.
Yeah,
now.
Something like that. And then, you know, he did a whole media tour. Like, I remember seeing him on some like cable show and he was talking about, you know, I would like to invite this gentleman into my home to see if he would say this in front of my wife and family and that kind of stuff. But so, you know, at this point, Bret Stephens has, you know, successfully magnified this tweet, you know, the influence of this tweet by like a millionfold, because like no one had fucking seen this tweet. The person who tweeted it had, you know, a couple hundred followers. Bret Stephens was not tagged in the tweet. This was not a reply to Bret Stephens, nothing like that. And this is where my recollection of events gets a little hazy, but I remember, you know, he followed it up with this this column about how, you know, whatever the insult had been actually had these like deep anti-Semitic roots. And then he linked to a thing that was like just, you know, a Google Books preview or something, where if you actually read it, it was saying, it was actually debunking the thing that he was claiming. So standards are falling at the failing New York Times, folks. But then at some point in this whole episode, Donald Trump gets wind of this and he starts tweeting the insult at Bret Stephens. And so
justice prevails.
So just to review, thanks to the action of none other than Bret Stephens himself, a tweet that had like two engagements insulting him went in the span of a few days from a guy with a couple hundred Twitter followers to the president of the United States hurling that insult to him on Twitter. And I mean, there's no bigger takeaway here. It's just very funny.
The new chapter in the continuing Star Wars saga, The Empire Strikes Back. Now, in our galaxy, The Empire Strikes Back.
We didn't exactly watch a movie on this episode, but I did watch a movie in my own personal life.
Yeah, sorry. The time we would have spent watching a movie was taken up trying to get a pretty rudimentary mic set up to work. Apologies, folks.
But as I said, I did watch a movie in my own personal life, and I think Luke has seen it. It's called The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, a couple times.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring this up because I had a great time watching it, by the way, and I've been on the record on this podcast and others as being ambivalent at best about Star Wars as a series of films and as a cultural phenomenon. And we can get into that later. But I hadn't seen The Empire Strikes Back in at least 15 years, possibly 20 years. And for a long time, I have been wanting to watch one of these old Star Wars movies in what I consider to be optimal condition, which is certainly not George Lucas's 1997 special edition, where he added all sorts of GIFs and kooky little effects and little digital touch-ups.
No, by optimal condition, you mean the changes that he's done to it subsequently, where there's even more like pyrotechnics and bullshit at it. That's what you mean.
I mean, yeah, so I can see
where
like,
we have like characters from the prequels or whatever, like added in, or like
Hayden Christensen.
The end of Return of the Jedi, where now when you see like all the smiley Jedi, you know, looking down on Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia from Jedi Heaven, but now it's like, yeah, Hayden Christensen.
I liked it when it was just when Anakin in that scene was played by like just a guy. Like some random guy.
Well,
that
he was
played.
He's played by the guy who, because you briefly do see Darth Vader's face at the end of Return of the Jedi.
And he's played by that guy.
Just played by that guy.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which also, incidentally, like, I mean, look, we're gonna get really pedantic here. You're gonna have like my 6-year-old Star Wars fanatic puritanical streak come out. But I mean, look, in the original Return of the Jedi, when you finally meet Darth Vader, AKA Anakin Skywalker, when Darth Vader reverts to being Anakin Skywalker at the end of Return of the Jedi, and then you see him in that final shot, the impression you get is that Anakin Skywalker, you know, when he turned to the dark side, was like a grown man, right? That's the point. That's the original point of Anakin Skywalker. He wasn't supposed to be some like brash, young, you know, Hayden Christensen type. He's supposed, the whole point of Darth Vader was that this was like a, you know, a wise guy in like his middle age, who was seduced by the dark side, which is what made it so tragic. And then in the prequels with Hayden Christensen, you know, it's just some like guy in his 20s who like never had it together in the first place. Like every time you see him do anything, he's just like at the beginning of Attack of the Clones or whatever, he's just jumping out of like, you know, like his flying spacecraft on Coruscant or whatever. And Obi-Wan is like, don't do that. That's a bad idea. He just does it anyway. He never had it together in the first place. It's a completely different character. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm interrupting you.
Well, that's an interesting point of view. I mean, you can go on Letterboxd right now and find any number of rhapsodic 5,000 word reviews by people saying that George Lucas's digital vistas that he created in Attack of the Clones are create beauty on par with Murnau.
We should watch Attack of the Clones for the podcast sometime, because it's one of the worst things ever made. That sequence at the end where they're on like what the fire planet, what is it, Mustafar, which by the way, I think I only know that from playing Star Wars Battlefront with my brother. There's that scene where somehow C-3PO has like lost his body parts or whatever, and he's just like a little head, or he's like a little torso, and there's the little flying guys and they're carrying him around, and he's like visibly CGI'd, like it doesn't look like C-3PO. I mean, that is...
I don't remember a single thing that you just said. I know that film has its fans, and I'm not among them.
Or you also get the contrarian defenses of Revenge of the Sith, where they're like, this is... I mean, it's not the best movie, but it's still better than Return of the Jedi. No, shut up. Wrong. It's bad. It's terrible. It sucks.
Yeah, I mean, I don't love Return of the Jedi either, so whatever. Who cares?
Okay, sorry. Can we just... This is now touched a nerve with me.
Okay.
But can we just talk about the fact for a second? I'm gonna let you.
I came here to praise The Empire Strikes Back, which I enjoyed.
I'm gonna let you finish. But like, can we just talk about the fact that the plot in the prequels doesn't even make sense? Okay, I have looked this up to try to make sense of it. I don't think it makes sense. It's in Attack of the Clones where Obi-Wan Kenobi goes to whatever that planet is with the weird gravity. Was it Kamino?
I don't know.
Whatever. It's the clone planet. It's the place where they make the clone troopers.
I just remember the scene with the sand.
Sure. Okay. That's whatever. I don't know what that is. That's half the scenes in Star Wars.
No. It's in Attack of the Clones when he says,
"Oh, I don't like sand." Right. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, that's the main scene I remember.
Okay. Well,
I remember the scene where he kills the younglings, which I've learned on Letterboxd is like the most tragic.
That's
scene
in Revenge of the Sith. But okay.
No. There's a scene, or what is it? There's a scene in where he kills a bunch of people in Attack of the Clones too. I've learned on Letterboxd that not since the Passion of Joan of Arc has there been such tragedy in cinema.
Well, I think that's when he goes back to Tatooine, right? And then his mom is dead or something.
Right, yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter.
It really doesn't.
But so he go. Obi-Wan Kenobi goes to the clone planet, right, where they've cloned Jango Fett, and then there's like a million Jango Fetts, and this is the clone army. And he's going to investigate. But then the people there are like, oh, you know, thanks for dropping in. You know, we've been wondering if the council, meaning whatever the, you know, galactic council or whatever the ruling body is or whatever, they're like, they ostensibly ordered these things. And then Obi-Wan like has never heard of this. And then they cite some random Jedi called like Master Sifo-Dyas or something. Like, he placed an order. Is he going to come check in? And then Obi-Wan's like, oh no, he's been dead for 10 years or something. So what the fuck are we to make of this? Who ordered the clones and why? Did the Emperor secretly order the clones, or before he's the Emperor, whatever, Senator Palpatine, did he secretly order the clones years earlier? Like, he's thinking 20 years ahead or something. He's like, I'm going to build a clone army without anyone's knowledge on a distant planet. Then I'm going to go on to this distant planet of Naboo, and I'm going to have a trade cartel start a blockade, which I'm then going to use to create a political crisis to get rid of the sitting chancellor. Then there's going to be a state of emergency. I'm going to ride in. I'm going to become chancellor. Then I'm going to start a civil war, even though I already control both the clone army and the side, the Confederacy or whatever, going to, you know, be ranged against it or whatever. Like, how fucking convoluted is this plot? What is the plan here? And it doesn't make any sense.
That's interesting. What I've learned from Letterboxd is that actually at a time when almost nobody in the US media had the courage to stand up to the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah, it's actually a statement about like fascism or something.
Well, who can forget in Revenge of the Sith when Anakin says, you're either with us or against us, and Obi-Wan says, only a Sith would deal in absolutes. We are hooting and hollering at the Woodbine Cinema when that happened.
Oh my God. Okay. Anyway, sorry. You want to talk, you watched The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. Which I think we can find some common ground on perhaps. I said 25 minutes ago that I was seeking out optimal condition to see it in. And now I intend to follow through on that thought. Cause I didn't want to watch the special edition, obviously. Didn't want to watch any other various editions. I know that online there have been fans who have done heroic efforts to create sort of definitive bootleg versions of like what the original trilogy originally looked like.
Yeah, and it's important to, I just want to interject here, the reason why people have had to do that, and you know, I've seen some of these efforts, you can torrent them, and they are really heroic. Like people have done tons of work to get as close to what the original release of these movies looked like. The reason is that, like, the Lucas Empire, and I guess by extension now Disney, has like, taken steps to make it so you cannot get these. Like, you would have to go to, like, a secondhand store to find the original versions, and
certainly you can't get them in really good condition. Like, through sort of official channels, the best way to see the original versions in the best quality is to get the Laserdisc release from the 80s, where you can see them in widescreen.
And who the fuck has a Laserdisc
player? Nobody has a Laserdisc player, and it's not...
No one had a Laserdisc player when Laserdisc was like a thing.
And it's not high definition, you know? Like the best versions are standard definition, but these fans have gone out and they've sourced original prints and they've done extensive restoration on them. Almost the minute these things came on video, they were already having adjustments made to them. Like A New Hope was not originally called A New Hope. It didn't originally say Episode 4 on the first print. It just said Star Wars, and then the crawl started. But then episode four was added. I think that's true. I'm sure there's some diehard fan who could maybe correct me if I'm wrong on that. Anyway, I didn't even want to watch one of these versions. I wanted to watch, for years I wanted to watch a shitty looking, like, scan.
This makes me think I've never seen the original, like, Star Wars.
Well, it's very hard. I've always wanted to see a shitty looking scan of, like, a beat up theatrical print. Like I would have loved to have seen a scratchy, well-loved print that used to play at a drive-in or a grindhouse or the second-run theater when these movies came out. And fortunately, I was able to find online some bootlegger has done just this. So I bought like a 3 Blu-ray set that some bootlegger has put together called the Star Wars Grindhouse version. That's just unrestored original prints from the original run of the 3 movies. And I watched The Empire Strikes Back. And, you know, the print, it doesn't look bad. It's scratchy. It's in decent enough condition. Like sometime around the reel change markers, it'll get especially scratchy. There's one reel that's a little more red than some of the other reels. But overall, I know, it looks like a real print. And I had such a great time watching it, and we can talk about why the movie is good, why the movie is the best of the Star Wars, but I've said this on this podcast before, something I've sort of resented about Star Wars is, I mean, we know the place that it holds in the history of film, that it was this, like, reaction to a decade of movies like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, or Straw Dogs, or The Conversation, or all of these revisionist movies, like The Godfather is a sort of revisionist gangster movie, and then along comes this movie by George Lucas, Star Wars, that is famously inspired by those old fun cliffhanger serials we used to watch when we were kids in the 1930s. Yeah. I think probably a little bit before George Lucas's time, but maybe he watched them on TV growing up. I don't know. And it's not revisionist at all. It's an updated version of those movies in the same way that an iPhone 13 is an updated version of an older iPhone. The fact that we've been living in Star Wars' world ever since is, I guess, the reason why I resent it. If it were just a one-off thing, that'd be cute and fun. You know, it's a fun children's movie. That's great. A fun afternoon at the movies. But it definitely, in the context of film history,
I would credit Star Wars a little further than that, I have to say, but
I don't know. I don't love A New Hope, to be honest. So I didn't have high expectations for The Empire Strikes Back. With that resentment in mind, one of the things I've always, ever since I came of age, had antipathy for in Star Wars is the way that it sort of feels sealed off from the time that it was made. It doesn't, at least in the special edition versions, it doesn't feel like a thing that came out in 1977. Many efforts have been made to keep it looking up to date, to make it look timeless. So many franchises have been popular over the years, whether it's James Bond, whether it's Batman, Godzilla, Jurassic Park, I don't know, name them, will tell you something about the time they're made in. Whereas Star Wars very consciously does not try to do that. And I've always wanted to see it looking like it came out in 1977 or 1980 to sort of situate it in time. And I feel like I got that watching The Empire Strikes Back this time. in its original form, I was just kind of blown away by the dizzying variety of special effects that are in it. Stop motion, puppetry, miniatures, matte paintings, some optical effects that today would look dated, but I think look, you know, quite beautiful.
Well, and the fact that they use like physical models and stuff like that. I mean, for A New Hope, when they did like the Death Star, you know, attack, the trench run, that scene. I mean, like when you see like the them fire at the surface of the Death Star and it explodes or whatever, they're actually crashing models into the, like when Red Leader crashes into the surface of the Death Star, they slammed a, you know, like a miniature X-Wing rigged with explosives and like, you know, made an actual explosion. And that frankly looks more timeless than all the CGI bullshit they did with the you know, special editions and prequels.
Or how about Yoda, who is a Muppet and at the time was understood to be a Muppet and people enjoyed him because he was a Muppet. He did not look like a photorealistic Jar Jar Binks like CGI creature. Not that Jar Jar Binks was photorealistic, but that was the idea. That's what George Lucas wanted to do. Like the craftsmanship of the Yoda puppet, the Frank Oz performance and the voice and the motion of the puppet, just all the little details of his face and his hair and his clothes, it's awe-inspiring. I guess it doesn't meet a certain standard of realism that we would accept as realism now, but so much of that is just what we're conditioned to accept as realism. There's a scene in Avengers Endgame during the big climactic...
You've seen Avengers Endgame?
Yeah, I have.
Oh man, I have not seen it.
During the big climactic brawl between every Avenger ever, every Avenger and every villain ever, every square foot of the screen occupied with a superhero, there's a scene in it where like all the lady Avengers come together. And they're like, we are here too. Or, you know, they say something that's very kind of like, you know, girl boss-ish energy. And you see them all appear together. And they obviously were not there on the set the same day. They were obviously grafted together. They had, I don't know, Brie Larson or whatever come in and pose in front of a green screen and scowl for 2 seconds so that they could graft her in with Michelle Pfeiffer from the Ant-Man or somebody else from this movie.
Scarlett Johansson,
all of them. That doesn't look realistic either. But the Yoda puppet has weight. He has texture. He has mass. The model ships, the model Millennium Falcon has texture and mass.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the same thing about Jabba the Hutt, right? Jabba the Hutt was also a really elaborate puppet in Return of the Jedi. When the special editions come out, you know, they had filmed the scene for A New Hope originally where before they leave Tatooine, Han Solo is confronted by Jabba the Hutt about, you know, the bounty on his head. And originally, Jabba the Hutt was just like a guy. So they'd filmed that scene and not included it in the original cut of Star Wars A New Hope. But when the special editions came out, they're like, hey, let's put Jabba the Hutt in here. And what we'll do is we'll like CGI Jabba the Hutt over like the original guy. So sorry, original guy who is Jabba the Hutt. You're kaput, you're gone, no one's going to see you. This could have been your comeback 30 years later, but no. Jabba the Hutt's an established thing, but we're not going to use a puppet. We're gonna have him be CGI. And he looks terrible. It's awful. It's worse than how he would look in a video game. It's awful.
I also think all of these special edition efforts, all these tweaks, are such a betrayal because, you know, in this idea of making the movie seem modern and up to date and constantly giving them this facelift, you do lose something very vital to what people loved about them. It's an effort to almost make it just about the story. It's an assumption that all that matters is Luke and Leia and Han and their dynamic. And that's what people love about Star Wars. But what people actually love is the texture. They love the sets. They love the way that the little models look like models and the claymation looks like claymation.
Right. And the whole innovation of Star Wars kind of aesthetically was that it dealt in kind of, you know, space and kind of stuff that is like encoded as futurist, but did so in a way that was channeled through a kind of like retro futurism from kind of, you know, the early and mid 20th century. And in channeling that, one of the things that really worked about the original Star Wars is that this universe looked ancient, right? It didn't look futuristic in a way. It looked extremely lived in. It looked very aged. You know, there was nothing glamorous about space travel. This was something that nobody in the Star Wars universe could remember anything before space travel. There's nothing kind of glamorous about it. You know, people do it.
Think about that scene in the canteen in A New Hope. What people love about that scene so much is it suggests a million worlds, a million stories that you could potentially explore. You got all these amazingly designed characters who are just interacting in this bar, and they've all got a story, but we're not going to see it. And that's great.
There's... Yeah, you got like the iconic cantina jazz band or whatever. Yeah. But how much do you want to bet that like in one of these like 15 million like Disney spinoffs, like the cantina band's going to get its own fucking spinoff, and you're going to learn about their days busking on Coruscant or whatever, and the fact, you know, how they were too avant-garde and they couldn't break through, and so they moved to the Outer Rim planets and they, you know, are relegated to playing the cantina on Tatooine.
By the way, I didn't see Ron Howard's solo A Star Wars Story.
I have seen it.
Okay, you find out there's that tossed off line.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Hope.
Someone must have heard about my little maneuver in the Battle of Tanad or whatever, and then you get to see the little maneuver.
Or he like we did the Kessel,
oh, the Kessel
Ridge.
Run. Yeah, 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 yeah. It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
I mean, I don't want to see. I don't want any more explanation.
She's fast enough for you, old man.
So the Empire Strikes Back.
Pretty good.
What is there to say about it? I gotta say that it does work. I was disappointed when I watched A New Hope last summer on TV because I felt that Mark Hamill was a bit of a wet blanket as a screen presence, and I felt that Harrison Ford really carried it, and yeah, that was about all there was to it. But in this one, I think both strands of the story work. I think the whole thing where Luke is trying to be, he thinks he's a Jedi, but he's really not a Jedi yet. And he hasn't quite overcome his fear, his anger, and Darth Vader knows this. All of that works. And then the love triangle between a brother and sister and their friend works. Yeah, I love seeing the will they or won't they tension between Han and Leia. And between Luke and Leia, frankly, that's fun too.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, like when I was like 5 or 6, I discovered Star Wars and I was really into it for a while. And The Empire Strikes Back, I used to really struggle with because, you know, you got the first part where, you know, the Empire attacks the rebellion on Hoth, and that's pretty bad. But, you know, everyone gets away and it's like, that's all right. And you got the whole chase scene with the Millennium Falcon, or, you know, just the extended chase where they're in the asteroid field and all that kind of stuff. I used to turn it off when they got to Cloud City because I knew what was coming. I was like, man, this Lando guy seems nice, but there's something's not right here. And the stuff on Cloud City used to bother me. When C-3PO disappears, when like Vader arrives and they torture Han Solo and he gets put in the carbonite, and then like Darth Vader confronts Luke, or, you know, maybe it's the other way around. But as a result, I watched Empire Strikes Back a few years ago and I realized I'd only seen like the final 45 minutes of it, like probably a few times, which is amazing.
Wow.
And it's good. It's obviously good.
Well, I also liked the look of the movie too. Like when Han Solo is being fed into that cryogenic freezing thing at the end, that scene, like the light in that scene, the duel between Luke and Vader at the end, the way that scene is lit, it's just like there's an electric energy to it. I love, there are 6 or 7 just beautifully designed space worlds in the movie. By the way, can I ask, since we are a culture and politics podcast, I do want to know if you give any credence to the political weight of the Star Wars movies. Do you think that there's any sort of parable in there that you take seriously? Is there anything the movies are saying that you take seriously politically?
Well, maybe I've no, but like maybe I've talked about it before. But there was a deleted scene that was not included in the original in Star Wars: A New Hope, where, you know, you meet the character later in A New Hope, but like Luke's friend Biggs, or whatever, his friend from Tatooine, who's like run off, joined the Imperial Military Academy, and then like defected to the rebellion or whatever, something like that. There's a scene where the two of them meet up on Tatooine and Biggs is saying to Luke, like,
I'm not going to wait around for the Empire to draft me into service. The rebellion is spreading and I want to be on the side I believe in.
Yeah, meanwhile I'm stuck here.
You'll get your chance to get off this rock. You're going to the Academy next term, aren't you?
Not likely. I had to cancel my application.
What for?
My uncle needs me.
Oh.
No, I'm serious. The Sand People have been getting really crazy. They've even raided the outskirts of Anchorhead.
Come on, Luke. Your uncle could hold off a whole colony of Sand People with one blaster.
I know. But we've got almost enough evaporators to make the place pay off. I have to stay one more season. I can't leave him now.
What good's all your uncle's work if the Empire takes it over? You know they've already started to nationalize commerce in the central systems? It won't be long before your uncle's just a tenant. slaving for the greater glory of the Empire.
No, that's not gonna happen here. You said yourself the Empire won't even mess with this old rock.
Things can change.
And then he has this line where he says something like, the Emperor is talking about nationalizing commerce in the Outer Rim territories or something like that.
Not bad.
So that, yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
Wait, so are Luke and Leia, like, are they Yang Gang or something? Like, what sort of a radical centrist movement do they...
Well, they're like fighting, you know, like the Empire is the USSR in that, right? Like, right. It's like they're doing like collectivization. And so the rebellion is fighting for, you know, freedom or whatever.
To become a Star Wars tanky and to realize that actually
the Empire
actually
represents
President Xi, also known as Darth Vader.
Yeah. No, but so, you know, they obviously like flirted with that and then decided to take it out. And so I think one of the reasons that Star Wars is so successful is because it's so utterly broad in its politics. Like, it is literally just a sort of like generic, like freedom versus tyranny. You can read the rebellion as revolutionary. You can read it as non-revolutionary. It can be about like, I mean, it is kind of about like, well, we just need to restore the balance. We need to bring back the Galactic Republic, which frankly seemed like it kind of sucked.
This is something I kind of resent about the Star Wars movies. This is part of the like textureless Teflon quality to A New Hope that I don't love. But, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I saw Star Wars, and then a couple of months later, the special editions came out, and I just remember Star Wars as a phenomenon hit the schoolyard like a tidal wave, and 2 or 3 years, it was just all anyone ever thought about, all anyone talked about. It was this universally agreed upon, at least among kids at my school, boy kids at least, but maybe girl kids too, that this was the coolest thing there ever was.
Well, do you remember like all the toys and stuff? Like, do you remember you'd go to your Taco Bell or whatever and you get like a little like Yoda thing to put your drink in or whatever? Like, I remember for a few years, those were all the rage. I remember the first time I came into any money as a kid, like I had like $100 or something. I remember buying this kind of, I mean, speaking of The Empire Strikes Back, this sort of Hoth play set thing. I was probably just like $30, but it felt like, you know, it felt like a king's ransom at the time. And I remember just thinking it was such a big deal that I'd purchased this.
Well, I remember when Phantom Menace came out, convincing my mom to buy me this hardcover book that was designs or blueprints of the various Star Wars ships, the spaceships in the movie, because I said, this is going to be worth twice as much in 20 years.
Oh, man, I love it.
Which it's not.
Yeah, right.
We're here right now, and it's not.
Yeah, it probably has negative value at this point.
I can get it for a dollar anywhere, because everybody bought that book thinking the same thing.
You could take it to BMV, and they would probably refuse to buy it. They've got, like, we got a job lot of these upstairs. But the Star Wars Hoth playset, like, thinking about it in retrospect, this was the coolest thing ever at the time. But in retrospect, thinking about it, it was probably pretty shitty. By the way, if anybody knows what I'm talking about, sound off in the comments. I'm going to describe it for you. It was this thing that can't have been more than like, I don't know, a square foot or something. And it sort of was like a little bit of snowy area. And then there was like the base with the little shield generator. I think was like a thing you could like pick up and move and put down. It had a couple of those, the Imperial AT-ATs. It had like a rebellion transport. And then it had like, I think a little, few of the little snow speeders or something. I think it might have had Luke as like a little guy, and he has a little like lightsaber, maybe a few other people. But what was so hilarious about all of these Star Wars toys is how, and they had a number of other sets in this collection, like I think I might have later had like an Endor, you know, speeder bike one or something. I think I had a Tatooine one, but nothing was to scale, right? Like the little Luke Skywalker was like the same size as his snow speeder, and the snow speeder wasn't that much smaller than the AT-AT, which should have like towered over it. And it's a testament to how, you know, much better in some ways your imagination is as a kid, that I just got so much entertainment out of this. Like, imagining every alternative Hoth scenario where somehow the rebellion just, like, keeps the Empire at bay and they don't have to evacuate, or I can't think of what any other alternative scenarios would be, but there were thousands of them, and I would just sit there for hours playing with this thing.
Yes, and fortunately, I've grown up since then and left childish things behind.
Yeah, now you just collect Screw magazine.